Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Stock.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks. I feel like I'm at Marine World or SeaWorld with all the trained SEALs. They've all learned to clap, and it's so exciting to see. Well, I want to thank you all for being with us tonight at the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub, where tonight we're going to do one of our music shows, which is a show that consists of listening to some music, exploring some lyrics. You know, music, and we're going to do a conference on this later this year, music as a language of God. And we have a conductor coming from Oxford University. He's going to be doing a choral presentation of Rayfound Williams, who was not a Christian composer. Nevertheless, his music approaches a certain level of kind of the mystical and the spiritual and the transcendent. And we want to explore the idea of music as a language in and of itself, with or without lyrics. As a matter of fact, one of my best friends is here tonight, and his company, it was involved in writing music. And when he would walk in the company, you'd pick up a mug, and it would say, "Not by words alone," because music itself is a language. But it is true that when the lyrics are thoughtful, it's a language all the more so. And tonight we're going to get an opportunity to explore some lyricists who have something to say and who are exploring some important ideas and also write some pretty good music. Our topic is Beatnik Spirituality for Today, the New Dylans, a look at Dylan, and we're also going to be hearing from The Long Winters, Bright Eyes, Cold War Kids, and our guests are Chris and Iron and Wine. Our guests are Chris Esty, who has been writing about music in Seattle since 86. He's written for The Rocket, The Stranger, Seattle Sound Music, and other publications. Let's have a big round of applause for Chris Esty. Wow. Those of you listening by podcast, you hear the screech of Chris's mother in the audience. It's a very emotional evening for her. Molly Rose, Seattle Sound Magazine said of Molly Rose, she draws intricate landscapes of narrative poetry. Her music is as driven by the intrinsic rhythms of her words as by whatever nameless muse guides her. There's nothing conventional about her songs, but she's hardly a weirdo folk singer. She's just a lovely songwriter, and if you're ready to listen closely, you won't be disappointed. Listen closely tonight to Molly Rose. Let's hear it for Molly. We'll talk to our Slovenian friend later and find out whether she's in fact a weirdo folk singer, but it'll be a personal matter. Robert Diebel is with us. Robert's music has been described as wistful folk pop, sparsely arranged, gracefully performed, and achingly beautiful to behold. And Robert, in addition to being a wonderful singer-songwriter, is also someone who has a practice of therapy and counseling with a particular focus on the artistic community. Let's hear it for Robert Diebel. So it's important for you to know that the construction of this show is very improvisational, so much so that I did not actually know what we were talking about tonight, which should become pretty obvious. At least I didn't know until a few days ago, because I asked Chris, who usually appears on this show with Jeff Cuse, and Jenny Spohr, the producer of this show, to kind of come up with a concept for this show. And Jeff couldn't be here, and that created an opportunity for us to get in touch with Robert Diebel and then Molly. And together, somehow, they came up with this idea of Beatnik Spirituality for Today, the New Dylans. Chris, I think this kind of was born in your brain. So what was it that you were angling towards when you came up with that concept?
Well, Jeff and I had been talking about doing something on Motown, and I really wanted to do something on Dylan and some of the New Dylans, and we were discussing artists like Nick Cave and other people that sort of have very interesting spiritual and aesthetic viewpoints that are performing now. And the whole concept of high and low culture collapsed into a homogenized form for your average listener, and that hasn't been really done universally since Dylan. And this brought up, you know, issues with Molly, for example, in our email exchange. about, is anybody really a new Dylan? And does anybody really care about that? I think that's an interesting juxtaposition, is to, I can't wait till we can do the Motown show, but I wanted Jeff to be here for that, because that was very important to him, and I think we'll have a gospel guy on, too, who...
Interesting.
Who does, yeah. And, but there's a lot, when you go to the EMP Pop Conference every year at the Experience Music Project, they have papers. Some are academic, some are more entertaining on all this stuff, and they do a lot on gospel. And so I think we'll bring in some energy on that.
So how did the idea of the new Dylan strike the two of you, Molly and Robert?
Well, I think the idea of the new Dylans was a little daunting because it, as Molly kind of mentioned, it's like you have a maturity of a songwriter that has gone over so many years and displayed so many aspects of his life that it's pretty hard to find anyone to step into those shoes.
But what's interesting is we're dealing with the early Dylan in a lot of the music tonight. So, I mean, Dylan was young when he was
the early
Dylan.
That's where the beatnik thing came in.
Yeah. But so now, how did you react, Molly? I heard something about Donovan.
Well, I take issue with bringing Dylan to the spot of, or at least that Dylan could be included in the group of Bach or Rachmaninoff and his genius and his capacity to affect pop culture and make a huge change. But it's hard for me to think about a new Dylan in the sense of comparing someone else's songwriting to his stylistically, because in essence, it won't do the same thing. It has to be something that's completely different than what's been done before.
Yeah.
It brought up the whole concept of what did Dylan do? And one of the things we kind of came up with is that he pulled from so many different pools and schools of thought, which just was not in pop music at the time. And you could just say he was formally schooled in folk, and he wrote some of the most beautiful traditional lines of lyric. But then, you know, when he fell into the beats, he totally fell into that visceral sort of just abstract, putting incongruous language together that just became incredibly imaginative. Huh. And that was completely different.
So now the idea of beatnik, Jack Kerouac introduced the phrase, the beat generation, in 1948. How many of you were alive in 1948? Not very many. Matter of fact, did you all hear the story in NPR recently about Bob Dylan before a concert? I think it was in New Jersey, going for a walk in the neighborhood, and there was some kind of rundown buildings, and he was kind of exploring them and walking around, and a police car pulled up with a 22-year-old patrolman in and asked him for identification, and he didn't have any. And she said, well, what's your name? And she said, Bob Dylan, and she didn't know who Bob Dylan was. And so she was ready to take him in, and then another young policeman came, and they decided to take his word for it that if they took him to this huge hotel nearby, he could get ID, and they pulled in, and there were these giant buses of Bob Dylan's whole, you know, crew, and they realized he was probably a big deal. And they didn't know who he was. It's like when I interviewed Norman Mailer in Chicago, and I went up to the penthouse suite at the Four Seasons Hotel, and it has its own reception area. And I walked up to a young woman, maybe 27 years old, and I said, I'm here to see Norman Mailer. And she said, how do you spell that? And so I spelled it, and then she introduced me to his room, and I walked in, and he was sitting there with a pad of a big yellow legal pad and a pencil. He was writing something. And he said, 50 years ago, I was a young man in a hotel room by myself with a pad of paper and a pencil, and nobody knew who I was. And I didn't have the heart to tell him, hey, nobody knows who you are now. Just out in the hallway, somebody wasn't allowed to spell your name. You know, and it's so there is a generational thing here with Dylan. But it's really interesting when you think about the whole concept of beatnik and beat, because at a Brandeis forum, an academic forum, the subject was, is there a beat generation? That was the question. And Kerouac was at that presentation. And he said, it is because I am beat. That is, I believe in beatitude. And he actually got the concept from the Beatitudes. Beatitude, and that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son to it, who knows but that the universe is not one vast sea of compassion, actually, the veritable holy honey beneath all this show of personality and cruelty. And there was this kind of underground anti-conformist movement that got started in that era that created a lot of art. Now, how does that fit with beatnik spirituality as you understand it?
There's a great new book out by co-edited by Grail Marcus called A New Literary History of America. And Grail Marcus actually wrote an entire book on the song Like a Rolling Stone, which we'll be listening to. And there's a great quote from Bob Dylan. This is regarding his song to Woody. And I just love how he wrote this. They lived as husband and wife, or brother and sister, or cousins. It was hard to tell. They just lived here, that's all. Chloe had her own primitive way of looking at things, always would say mad stuff that clicked in a cryptic way. Told me once that I should wear eyeshadow because it keeps away the evil eye. I asked her, who's evil eye? And she said, Joe Blows or Joe Schmoes. According to her, Dracula ruled the world and he's the son of Gutenberg, the guy who invented the printing press. Being as an heir of the 40s and 50s cultures, this kind of talk was fine with me. Gutenberg could have been the guy who stepped out of a folk song, too. So essentially, beatnik writing is tied to automatic writing, which is a sense of an iron cord into the earth, a sense of anything can happen, possibility. In Like a Rolling Stone, the drumbeat at the beginning separates the past from the future. And it's Dylan's way of saying, you're either with this thing that's happening, or you're part of the past. You're part of black and white culture. You're part of those sort of modalities. And Like a Rolling Stone is the exemplification of a beatnik song. It's what Jimi Hendrix tried to play to the hipsters in New York, and they were busy selling speed, and they didn't really want to hear it, but it touched Hendrix's heart. So when he came back to Seattle, you know, he loved this music. And it was the same kind of music that just, that song, it was so loose that the musicians couldn't keep up with Dylan's improvisational tone when he sang it. If you listen to it, it's a little bit behind him, because how do you keep up with Dylan? And that's what Dylan demanded, like with Kerouac. People should be firecrackers. There should be Roman candles that go off. And Dylan was one of those people. And he assimilated that even as he went into folk singing. But by the time he changed history with rock and roll with that song, it was evident to everyone in popular culture that this was true.
Let's listen to Like a Rolling Stone. And then you're going to play along with it a song by Long Winters. But let's listen to Rolling Stone, Like a Rolling Stone, and the lyrics.
Everybody that was hanging out, now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging.
So you chose this song to start us on beatnik spirituality. Talk about how this fits the theme.
Jan Werner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, basically said that this song completely liberated him. Some people could take it, and very easily so, as an accusatory song about a spoiled rich girl who just loses everything and she has to learn how to cope in the real world. And Jan Werner had written an editorial in the very first issue of Rolling Stone, which... all of them, the band, the Rolling Stones, Like a Rolling Stone, and the magazine Rolling Stone are all based on a Muddy Waters song, as liberation, giving it all up in order to embrace the world nakedly, to come into a an openness and a freedom of thought that would integrate you with the human community and make you less of a thing, an institutionalized thought being, and more of a existing, living, breathing human being willing to consider anything and have all kinds of experiences. And Like a Rolling Stone was like the zenith of Dylan's beatnik writing. At that point, he completely modernized. He left behind the folk songs, the deep Scottish and French boheme, the affectation of pretty, beautiful, weird little old weird America ballads that he was so well known for and is still so great at. He's never left anything behind. He's never rejected anything. But this is when he basically told everyone, it starts now. Are you with me? Is the modern life going to start now?
So it was a departure, Richard, for sure. And what you're describing kind of sounds a lot like the existentialism of the day, living in that moment.
It starts with Once Upon a Time. Now, Molly chose a song later on called Desolation Row that is the final track on the same record, and it starts with the line, they're selling postcards of the hanging. And so you... And, you know, Joseph Heller once said, a novel is when something happens. And if you have a song at the beginning of a record that starts Once Upon a Time and ends with they're selling postcards of a hanging, I think that record probably is saying something.
So now you've tied this together with Long Winter's song, Commander Thinks Aloud. How'd you make that connection?
It's an interesting... essentially, Dylan has a tendency to layer words and meanings. And what Roderick is doing, John Roderick, the lead singer-songwriter of Long Winters, is he's peeling away. This is a song that was released on an EP, it's like a mini LP. And people don't really respect those as much as forms. In the punk rock days, they were respected, like the Buzzcocks and other bands had EPs that were really well respected. This record is my favorite of theirs. And it's the opening track. And the main thing that's going on, I won't tell you what's going on because you'll hear it. And what happens in the song is it's the opposite of Like a Rolling Stone. It's someone who's not accusing someone else of being spoiled and having to lose everything. It's somebody losing everything and what's still important to them at the end.
Okay, here we go. When I was listening to that, and I wish we could have had the lyrics in front of us, but I was thinking about what Robert or Molly said about, Dylan was in, and the beat movement was a movement of newness. You know, there was nothing derivative about it, and so in that sense, the question of new Dylans is not really playing into that territory, but. I really like that song. I'm not finding it breaking new territory. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I think. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting that you say that the beats or Dylan is breaking new territory. Dylan did something that changed what was happening presently, but the beats were a knockoff of James Joyce.
Yeah, good point.
And other writers who, I mean, what was happening musically at that point, what changed, it seems like, whether or not it was Dylan that actually changed it or that it was the times that allowed for Dylan to be that individual that changed it, was that it was possible for somebody who wasn't a, who didn't fill the role of being a musician in the sense that the classical writers were. You grew up to be an artist or a musician, but if you weren't schooled that way, you didn't write music. And Dylan made it possible for a whole lot of really bad songwriters.
Well, there you go.
Because then it became something that anybody could do, you know, that you could express what you were thinking. The Beats did the same thing. I mean, Joyce took it to the level of stream of consciousness, and I'm sure that there were many other writers, yeah, thank you, but that were also doing something similar at the time of Joyce that I am not aware of, but that I know that are there. But the Beatniks said, oh, well, you know, that seems kind of like I could probably do that, you know, like Picasso, mm-hmm. you know, he's just doing some cubes and stuff.
A little Benazrine. And
yeah. Like
sure.
We went to, I was at the SAM recently, and Target Practice is the new exhibition. I think it just went down now. But that came out at about the time, I think, that, well, a bit before Dylan, I think. I don't know. I get my dates really mixed up, but it was right after World War II, and it became something like it started in two different areas of the world. I think it was, I'm gonna forget the countries too, but it was two separate areas of the globe that two different artists. I think it was a Japanese artist and an Italian artist thought, you know, what happens if we tear the canvas apart? And it was the idea of deconstructionism, you know, that you can pull it to pieces and see what happens, which is interesting. But what happens now that everything's been pulled apart?
Yeah. But loop this back to Long Winters in this particular piece. You know, how does it fit?
Everything's falling apart.
Everything's falling apart. And so you're going from the end of Highway 61 Revisited by Bob Dylan, in which everything is falling apart in Desolation Row, which we'll turn back to. But it's expressed in contemporary, postmodern, minimalist language. And no, there's no revolutionary ground broken in that song. It is actually similar to Space Oddity by David Bowie. But we live in a generation in which we've accepted that most things aren't going to be that new. What is refreshing in the song is the sincerity by the end of it that he has lost everything and all he's bringing back is whatever is left to the woman that he loves. And I don't know why my wife loves me. I have no idea.
I don't either.
Yeah. and you know her. And the thing is that every now and then I have this feeling that she loves something that I can't explain, and he can't explain it either. It could have to do with his soul.
We're going to pick up there when we come back. Molly Rose is going to sing for us. We're going to find out whose side God is on and more. You're listening to Kindling's Muse. This is Dick Staub. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dick Staub back with you. You're listening to the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub, where among our guests tonight, one of our guests is Molly Rose, and she's going to sing something for us at this time. Let's have a big round of applause for Molly Rose.
Thank you. It's so curious not having a microphone in front of my face, and when I cough, I can't look away. It just follows me whichever direction I go. Here is the doo-wop. Sing. Hey, sing. You look like a god with your head thrown back. Your eyes shining like that. So sing, hey, sing. I don't know if you're true. You're someone I ought to be caught praying to a saint. Hey, sing, let the light shine down. We will see the life in you. All the shadows are gone. Yeah, sing. Oh, sing. You look like a god with your head thrown back and your eyes shining like that. The morning is here and we will see our siren or leopard or saint. Are you a siren or a leopard or a saint?
Wow. Thanks, Molly.
Sure.
It was awesome. Out of Jackson, Wyoming, ladies and gentlemen.
It's awesome. Most recently.
Huh?
Most recently, and before that was Fresno, which is quite the contradiction.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Sounds like a folktale.
The exotic,
probably.
The exotic journey from
it's
Fresno to Jackson, Wyoming to Seattle.
Oh, boy.
Well, Robert, you chose a couple of songs here. Dylan's God on Our Side.
Yeah, you know, let's start with Bright Eyes, because we'll start with the Aberration and go to the source.
So you want to listen to Bright Eyes first,
yeah.
And then, so set us up on how you chose Bright Eyes, or you just want to get into it?
Yeah, well, it was based in reaction to the new Dylans and Are There. And this is, I think, an example of someone that kind of comes across utilizing the legacy of Dylan, and whether he really has the ability to have that depth, I don't know. That's up for you to decide. But it's certainly someone that has kind of utilized his style to say something in opposition to current political status quo.
Okay, this is Bright Eyes, When the President Talks to God.
When the president talks to God, are the conversations brief or long? Does he ask to rape our women's rights and send poor farm kids off to die? Does God suggest an oil hike when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, are the consonants all hard or soft? Is he resolute up down the line? Is every issue black or white? Does what God say ever change his mind when the president talks to God?
So compare and contrast these two a bit.
Well, the first thing I'm going to mention here is that Dylan goes for frickin' 7 minutes long. He's not looking for a hit here. He might be trying to change your conscience, but he's not looking for a hit. The other thing I really think is important is Dylan puts himself in the song. He's posing a question in which he's involved in, where Connor from Bright Eyes is making a pronouncement, and he's using a kind of a status quo of dissent to ride a popular uprising. Dylan wasn't. It had just barely formed, and he's in the folk tradition at this point, and so there is that stream. But there's a definite distinction between the two.
Totally. When you first heard When the President Talks to God, how did it strike you? Did you think of this comparison immediately?
No, I laughed because I thought it was funny. I mean, I was driving around in my car, and I just, To me, it was to some extent it was that beatnik spirituality thing that the people are just getting pissed. I mean, they may not have thought through it, but they were tired. And I think one thing Bright Eyes does do well is they put into lyric an assumptive quality that our politics have had for the last 8 years. That God is on our side, and don't ask questions. And I'm not necessarily a fan of how he's gone about it.
When I was listening to the two of them, I thought of this quote by Annie Dillard, which is one of my favorites, and I see Dylan in it, and I don't see when the president talks to God in it. And this is the quote. Annie Dillard's talking about the serious calling of writing. And she says, one of the few things I know about writing is this: spend it all, shoot it, play it, lose it all right away every time. Do not hoard what seems good for a later place. Something more will arise for later, something better. Assume you write for an audience consisting solely of terminal patients. That is, after all, the case. What could you say to a dying person that would not enrage by its triviality? And the one seems trite by comparison, because Dylan's is anything but trivial. I mean, whatever position you have on war or on any specific war, there's nothing trivial about the way Dylan approaches it.
Except that the interesting thing with that particular song by Bright Eyes, I don't particularly like or admire that in contrast to Dylan's. However, what is present in our pop media right now, and what happened when Conor Oberst wrote that song, was that he was on, who's the main nighttime guy from 11 to midnight? The big guy, he's
big
not
chin,
there anymore.
Big chin.
No, it wasn't Leno.
Was it Leno?
It was the other guy, the older one.
Letterman.
Yes.
Letterman.
Letterman, thank you. Thank you very much.
I love it.
Sounds
the older one. That old guy.
Well, he's not on there anymore, right? They took him off. I haven't. But I heard about this because I don't, again, particularly admire Conor Oberst. I listened to him when I think I was 20, and he's very vehement and very passionate, and it's earnest, you know? So you kind of tie into that. But I respected that he had been on Letterman and that they were having him play a song that night, and it was, I think, right before the election, 2004, right after that. And they said, you know, the one song we don't want you to play is this song. And he was like, all right.
And
that was the song he played.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's not Dylan, but I mean, in the context of what exists on TV presently, it kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a good point, because I think one thing that we've kind of had to wrestle with is that we are so entrenched in this media crap that it's really hard to...
They won't play a seven-minute song.
We don't see this stuff coming out anymore. We don't have the patience for language that existed then.
Right.
And we don't have the
patience. Well, but put that in the context of the music that came out of the late 50s and early 60s. It wasn't, it
well,
was
that's
very
good point.
Trite.
That's good
you
point.
Know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But
really,
radio
really
was
stupid,
new.
Silly, you know, blue suede shoes stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Dylan was willing to do it regardless of what was going on around him, I think, is part
maybe
of
Annie
but
Dillard
see, it's
is
not
the new
just
Dylan.
The risk. I hear what you're saying about risking singing the song on Letterman that he didn't want him to sing. But then when you sing it, if it doesn't have ballast and strength that really carries it, not only artistically but intellectually, it's a squandered moment. You know, and that's the frustration of people that are trying to take a stand for things they believe in but don't have the technical skills and abilities to pull it off.
It's
the language.
Well,
use
I was going to say this. I think Bright Eyes made a very clear point that cut through the media world, and maybe nothing else could have done that but a blatant cut.
Yeah.
What Dylan does that I love in this song is that he goes beyond the political sphere, and he makes a theological statement, and he really causes us to think. And he's in many dark hours. I've been thinking about this: that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. but I can't think for you. I'll have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on its side, because Judas won.
Yeah.
You know, basically. And it posed a question, which I think, to me, that's the fundamental cornerstone of spirituality, is willing to pose that question. Whether it's posing a question about whether God exists, or the question of does God exist?
Or what kind of God exists?
Or what kind is it?
Yeah.
And I think both sides of that, that's where the pendulum swings to the middle, and I think spirituality is found there. And I found recently one of our beloved Seattle songwriters, David Bazan from Pedro the Lion, who has now come out in a lot of media press saying he's agnostic. But he writes this, and I couldn't but help to notice the comparison. He says in his recent album, in the song Stitches, when Job asked you the question, you responded who you are, to challenge your creator. Well, if that one part is true, it makes you sound defensive, like you had not thought it through enough to have any answer, or you might have bit off more than you can chew. Mm. And he's talking to God there, and he's shaking the tree. Mm. And I think it's interesting.
Do you want to add something?
I just want to say that part of beatnik spirituality and spirituality in general is the now, is what's happening right now. Grail Marcus, again, the guy who wrote the song on Like a Rolling Stone. And again, Like a Rolling Stone is about, boom, it all begins now. And you have to let go of the past and start living. This includes embracing the music that's going on now. When Grail Marcus was asked in the early 90s to contribute to a tribute to Woodstock, he was like, well, there was a lot of good music at Woodstock, a lot of cool things. But then he listened to what was going on with this tribute, and every 10 minutes, some guy in a tie-dyed shirt would go, ah, you should have been there. And, you know, like, he's seeing good artists, and he's seeing, you know, interesting ideas, but, you know, every now and then some guy would come and go, ah, you should have been there. And basically, Marcus didn't want any part of reminding people how it was better then. Dylan was hugely informed by literature, by folk songs, by all those things that personally, individually, he encompassed, and which anybody could do today too, you know. And I believe a new Dylan could come up at any time. The ones we're discussing, possibly deficient.
Well, let's move on to another bright, cheerful song. By Molly. Molly chose Desolation Row.
Whee!
Which is also destined to be a hit, mm-hmm. in that it's 8 minutes long.
Sorry, I'm sorry, I didn't. My record player was broken.
And by the way, I want to mention to you listening by podcast, we will have links to all of these lyrics so that you'll hear just a little bit of the music, and then you have to go to the lyrics to the website, thekindlings.com, to get linked to all these lyrics. But you chose Desolation Row, and what was it about this song that you wanted to start with? Or do you want to do what Robert didn't start with? You're going to do an Iron and Wine, right?
Which
do you want to start with?
Which do I want to start with? I'd like to start with, we should start with Dylan.
Okay, everybody ready? Desolation Row, it's the 13-page document.
And really, honestly, my record player, I got this record a while ago, or collected it from my dad, and it had little skips on it, and so I was like, it was.
It
was
never
shorter.
Knew how long
and it
was.
Kept skipping over lines, and I thought, okay. And I didn't know it was 8 minutes
okay,
long.
Okay, here we go. This is Desolation Row.
Ophelia, she's neath the window. For her, I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid. To her, death is quite romantic. She wears an iron vest. Her profession's her religion. Her sin is her lifelessness. And though her eyes are fixed upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into Desolation Row.
So considering to comment on that or go into Iron? What would you like to do?
No, I'd love to, because I think that the thing that ties, well, firstly, I think that one of the things that constitutes good art and also therefore good songwriting is that you can hold absurdity and truth very closely together and with a lot of tension between the two. And I think that that's what he does. And Desolation Row, and the thing that happens when you hold the absurd with what you think might be true, or in your seeking of what is true, it's difficult, because you can go to one side and you can yeah, exactly, you can throw shit, but when you take the role of the character who may have shit thrown at them, then you're going to see a lot more complexity there. And I think that that's what Dylan is capable of, and when he does it well. And I think that the next song is by Sam Beam. Iron and Wine is the name of his project. And this expresses a little bit of that. Like, it's the same idea of naming, and of calling you into a position where you need to contemplate what it is that you're experiencing in the song. So like, Rilke has a poem called The Archaic Torso of Apollo. And the idea of that is that when you come into interaction with a real piece of art, or a real work of art, I should say, you can either ignore that you had that experience, or you come away from that changed. And you're changed by it because you participated with it, and so yeah, next song.
Okay, this is Iron and Wine. God Made the Audible.
Praise on the wanting for time, and aches in the sleepless way.
Back with more of the Kindling's Muse right after this. We'll go to the questions and answers from the audience. Questions and answers from the audience, and we'll also hear some music from Robert Diebel. Stick around, we'll be right back. Dick Staub back with you. Thanks for joining us for the Kindling's Muse. We're going to hear some music from Robert Diebel and then get right to the questions that the audience has tonight. Let's have a big round of applause for Robert Diebel.
Yeah. black cars, feel your vaccine. Solitaire ripper that flies at night. Autumn leaves now taking flight. Silver light comes piercing still bright blue scapels wounding thought of you in the light of flies night. Break this darkened heart to breathe some light.
That was great. And for those listening to the podcast, if you go to thekindlings.com, you can find a link to Molly Rose and Robert Diebel and learn more about their music and enjoy some more of their music. We're going to get going to the audience from the question. We'll try to keep it moving quickly in the interest of time. We'll get started with Ken.
Okay. It seems that when Dylan became an icon of the 60s generation, even those who didn't like him or and didn't like his music knew of him and could even recognize his music. My parents, for example. How do you see the medias and the recording industries and connected with that, the communication technology's role then and now when it comes to even the possibility of a new Dylan? Can there ever really be one?
It's a great, great, great question.
I think there are no new Dylans. There are only new Donovans.
Just in case anybody, the new Donovan concept. You want to elaborate, Molly? That's your line. Right?
It was because I was frustrated with the concept of creating a new Bach or a new Dostoevsky. And so then Donovan popped to mind because, you know, they asked Dylan what he thought of Donovan, and he was like, who? I don't care. You know, because I liked some of Donovan's songs, you know? I mean, yeah, you know, you kind of, you can get into that, but... But it's not the same thing. So in regard, though, to your question, I think that presently, the way that I find music and the way that I specifically find artists that I love, I find through subterranean channels. You know, I find through magazines that I respect, and I find through other artists that I really respect. And I don't think that that was the case at the time that Dylan became something that everybody was aware of, and that the Beatles became something that everybody was aware of, and that, you know, Joan Baez and the other people who were present at that time. And so, yeah.
Okay, Marty.
All right, so I'm going to be the curmudgeon here. So looking at the new Dylan, and maybe what's common about the Dylan thing is it's all about the words and not the music, right? And that's sort of rhetorical, so hang on a second. So I guess my question is, why have a beat at all? Does this stand as poetry by itself, or does it need some sort of rudimentary musical accompaniment?
Well, I would like to say that, like, we were talking about Robert Christgau, the rock critic in New York, dean of rock critics, who was saying that essentially Dylan's music and lyrics, they go together. And the reason why he's beatnik spirituality is his work is loose. It's not technically adept, necessarily. The only period in his career in which his stuff was really tight, according to Christgau, was the two gospel records he did. And they don't swing like the rest of his records do, but they're not considered deficient by most rock critics. But when it comes to Dylan and his music, essentially, are you asking whether it needs music or not? Is it just lyrics, or?
So, as a musician myself, I tend to, when I look at songs, I tend to say, if this was being sung in French and I don't understand it, I'm still attracted to it, and I wish I knew what the language was. If Dylan, the majority of Dylan's songs, especially the ones you played tonight, not some of his early stuff I really like, and then but some of the stuff I heard tonight, if it was being sung in French, I would say, oh yeah, let's just turn that off. I really don't care what he's saying. Because of the music and the production, but what it's so that's why I'm saying it seems like the words are the most important thing.
I think mine holds up. I think their two are relying on lyrics. I think Like a Rolling Stone has a musical looseness and flow. The other ones, I don't know. I would listen to Desolation Row because it's like a Jeremy ad.
But without the lyrics is the question.
Yes.
If you just had the music.
Yes, it would be like Jacques Brel. It would be like a demented death waltz or a that would
okay.
be interesting.
So for those of you that love death waltzes, Dylan's your guy. Damien.
Hello, my name is Damien, and this is for Molly and all musicians present. Okay, wait, let me see, my hands are shaking. Okay, what are the essential songs that have not yet been written that you personally would love to hear? Or, lyrically, what do you think needs to be said today in song?
Who invited this guy? Was it you?
It's Damien, yes, yes. All right, Damien, I think what needs to be written is, since the present movement has been chaos and has been disruptive out of what was sort of like realism that existed within songwriting and within art and within like a societal structure, like I think what would be really interesting is to see how out of the sort of commonplace that we have and the chaos that we recreate in our songwriting and in our media, like how we replicate what we think is destructive and tragic and what we are appalled by. I would like to see somebody create something beautiful.
In a word?
Beautiful.
I mean, like in a noun? Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Like, because I don't think that that's easily done.
But you know, I was thinking earlier, before the show, you were talking about Madeline Engel, and one of the things she said about fiction is that you don't want to feel less after you've read a work of fiction. You want to feel more, and you want to feel that there's been some illumination.
I think
do you agree with that?
I don't know that particular reference. I know that that I borrowed her actually because that she said that real art is the capacity to create. Like it's that you use the chaos that's existence or the basic bits bumbling around in the universe and you create something that's yours out of it, but that you don't just replicate.
Let's go to Anthony.
Hello. Okay, so given how the Beatniks and Dylan took so many cultural left turns, shouldn't we expect that the new Dylans would sound less like Dylan, you know, kind of the guitar singer-songwriter, and more like maybe Tom Morello's bands or TV on the Radio or Mos Def?
Yeah, hip hop, actually. Yeah, definitely. Like hip hop is, I think, as far as like that stream of consciousness and the capacity to connect with society and politics and protest, as well as identifying with American society, is breathtaking presently.
So why didn't we have any hip hop in the selections?
I actually.
Why didn't we have any women in the selections?
Yeah, why didn't we have any women?
I know.
And notice, I mean, I didn't just name hip hop artists. I mean, there's plenty of hip hop artists, but bands like. Bands like TV on the Radio,
right.
where it's an entire experience that you're having with the music, and lyrically they're saying something, and they're doing stuff that you know, they're willing to make their own fans mad,
right? Like MIA or Bjork.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
We discussed having MIA's song, which is do you remember the title? It's based on Straight to Hell.
It's off of Clash. It's
Actually, Like a Rolling Stone, I brought that in specifically because it's been covered 6 or 7 times by hip-hop artists. It's constantly sampled, and it's considered like one of the early hip-hop songs. It's a taunt. It's an accusatory song on a minimalist beat. It's definitely TV on the Radio are an exceptional band that probably would be definitely defined as our new Dylans.
And those artists, like in the sense that they're using multimedia and drawing you into a full contextual experience, that is something that's new that wasn't possible before.
We're kind of bound by genre in terms of this discussion, because when you say the word New Dylan, these guys are folk rockers, and you know, once I fly into a genre, I can just dig it. And
well, I always can count on Lyle to bring out the depth of the subject, and he wants to tie into Like a Rolling Stone.
Like a Rolling Stone reminds me of someone I used to date. Do I need therapy?
Yes.
If you're coming to me, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much,
Robert
Lyle, for
Ballard.
Sharing your heart with us. Jim.
I thought of this also tonight, talking about the absurd lyrics, and also when I've seen Dylan perform on film. How much of his lyrics just kind of came to him as he's singing, just started to throw it off the top of his head, versus how much I've already carefully laid out ahead of time? Maybe you don't know the answer to that, but it's sort of a question that's been in my mind.
It seems like there was a departure around the time that the album just before Like a Rolling Stone came out, where he began writing lyrical content like a machine gun, where prior to that, he was writing more traditional verse that had a lot of thought towards it. I mean, I recorded a version of Boots of Spanish Leather, which is just an unbelievably thought through composition. And so you see a really huge change and departure when he starts getting into the beats, where it's just incongruous, you know, thoughts like Desolation Row.
John.
Okay, I was going to comment on the other one, but I won't. I will just go on. So when communism fell in Bulgaria, the first to profess a relationship with Christ were the musicians and the artists, and it was a radical stance against the prevailing culture. So did Bob's radical conversion signal a similar rejection of prevailing culture and power here?
Can you say that last part again?
Did Bob's radical conversion signal a similar rejection of prevailing culture here?
Radical conversion to Christianity?
Yeah.
Do you guys have something to say about that? I know that for a fact most people were questioning why Bob Dylan was going with what is perceived as mainstream values, that Christianity is part of mainstream culture. But that's not necessarily the world's view. That's an American viewpoint, American media viewpoint. I think it's a fascinating question what Bob's Christianity meant to other parts of the world, and I personally don't know.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the question. In terms of Bob's conversion, is that what you're saying?
He became a Christian.
Yeah.
What does it say against the... Was he rebelling against the counterculture that had become the established culture?
I think there's a pattern, and this is a psychological thought, but there's a pattern in Dylan's life that he, first of all, his parents sent him to college. He departed from that, took the money, and started writing music. They didn't even know about it. And his first press release was that he was an orphan, and his parents had abandoned him. They had to correct they had to put a press release out to correct that. He was then schooled and basically submerged himself into the formal traditional folk scene in Greenwich Village. He made a radical departure from that when he started hanging with the Beats in Ginsberg and all that. Then he made a huge departure from his tradition in folk music when he did the Electric thing. And then ultimately when he converted to Christianity, it was a massive departure from both his Jewish roots and the liberal left that he was such a huge part of. After three albums, he departed from that with the album Infidels. I absolutely agree with you. But the Christian public got frustrated with his integration of his life with what he had pulled from Christian.
And he was still in concert playing It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding at the end of concerts in 1979. When he did the gospel tour, originally he just did material off of the first two records. Inevitably, he began to see, and it's not hard to see why, his work was apocalyptic. Everything he'd been writing since the beginning was about the end of the world, was about morality. And in the most recent interview in Rolling Stone, he said his conversion was based more on reading like Ben-Hur or Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that he's always had a real attraction to morality. To answer your question, though, I actually do know that in the UK, most rock critics think that his gospel period is really punk, is really a way, they didn't want him to do loving ballads to Jesus. Many of them liked the fact that he did something that was hardcore evangelical, because that represented the doomy prophet of his earlier career.
Interesting. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and we decided that we would end tonight with That's How You Sing Amazing Grace. And Bob, why don't, or Robert. Robert, yeah, the new Bob Dylan is Robert Diebel. Bob Diebel, BD.
We come here to tell
Bob
you tonight.
Dylan, whoa.
Wow.
Blasphemy. Why did you choose this to end?
I just thought that on the topic of beatnik spirituality, that it's interesting where I find spirituality that actually moves me, which does not often come from cultural Christian venues. And here's a band of Mormon indie rockers that basically come up with one of the most moving experiences of spirituality I've heard in years.
It's called That's How You Sing Amazing Grace. The artist is Low.
Alan Sparhawk, interviewed in the Omaha Weekly Reader, said, "There's a place for complete joy in spiritual music. I don't think it's constructive," Sparhawk said. "At the end of the day, we'll all be singing hallelujah and praising God. There's nothing more powerful than that. But the reason we're living in this world is to grapple with tough decisions, light and dark. To completely shut yourself out of that fact is not solving anything. It's much more interesting and grappling. I really believe that God does give us decisions where we're supposed to assess and find the true answer. You don't learn things by being told what to do."
Hmm. What an interesting evening. What a thoughtful way to end the evening. I want to thank our guests, Chris Hesty, Molly Rose, Robert Diebel, for being with us, and all of you in the live audience for bearing with us through a longer than usual evening. And all of you listening to the podcast, thank you for joining us as well. Check out the website for more information and links on each of our guests. This is Dick Staub. You've been listening to the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub.